Good afternoon. This is, for the record, Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee. The date today is January 23rd, 2019, and we have three items on our agenda. We're going to start with Senator Jasinski's bill regarding disabled veterans' homestead market value exclusion, data sharing permission. It's a big title. I wanted you all to know that Senate File 58 is a re-referral passed to Judiciary from the Veterans Committee, and our focus is on data sharing element that's needing our review. So, Senator Jasinski, welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Feel free to start explaining your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Limmer. This is Senate File number 58, which is the Disabled Veterans Homestead Exclusion. If you remember, in 2017, the legislature passed a provision that eliminated the application requirements for the disabled veterans homestead exclusion and imposed requirement that the county veterans service officer certify the disability status of the veteran with beneficiary status to the county assessor in order to determine the eligibility for the homestead exclusion. However, the status cannot be certified unless the veteran consents to the release of the private data. This bill authorizes the county veterans service officer and the county assessor to exchange private data in order to make the veteran eligible to receive the disabled veterans homestead exclusion property tax benefit. That is the bill. Last year it got vetoed towards the end or at the final days, and we're bringing the bill back again this year. So with that, I thought I had some testifiers, but maybe I don't, so I'll stand for questions.
Senator Jasinski, what is the benefit that a veteran would receive in tax treatment?
I believe in the property taxes. Based on their disability, they get a credit towards the property taxes or off the property taxes. Okay. Based on the disability, the level of disability, you get a varying status from, I think, almost up to 100% property tax credit down to 10%.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak for or against this bill? We'll open it up for discussion. Anyone have questions or discussion regarding it? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, is this a discretionary option for the counties? Can the counties decide not to do that? Or if this law is passed in its form, are all 87 counties subjected to this? Probably not the right word, subjected, but nevertheless required.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I believe so, that they're all allowed to do that, but if they implement it or not, I believe it's up to each county to determine that. So it gives them the availability to do it. Whether the county enacts it is their decision, I believe, but I don't have my testifiers here to verify that.
Sir Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Line 1.10 says the word may. Is that to be construed as must in that?
Which line? I'm sorry, Senator.
1.10.
Senator Jasinski.
Yes, I believe that is their option to do that. So it is may. So it does not require them to do it, but allows them to do it if they choose.
Senator Hall.
And thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair. Senator Jasinski, is that what you want, is just to allow them, or you want to make them do it?
Senator Jasinski.
Senator Hall, I believe I want to allow them to do it if they choose. Oh. If they don't, I believe that's the intent of the bill, to allow them to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Anderson, did you want to ask a question? Anyone else? Senator Jasinski, I've always believed that Minnesota tax law is predicated on equal and fair treatment under the law for all citizens. So my question is maybe more of a tax question when it comes to the may. One county can and one county doesn't have to. How does that rectify the fair treatment between taxpayers?
Otherwise, I believe the county veteran service officer has to go out to the veteran themselves and have them sign off on it. This allows each county to do it if they decide to do it that way, exchanging the data back and forth between the county veteran service officer and the county assessor.
I see. Okay. Any further discussion? Again, anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? I'm not seeing anyone. Senator Hall moves that Senate File 58 be recommended to pass and be moved to the Tax Committee. That's where the tax questions will come in. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill prevails and is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Senator Hall, would you take over the helm here?
Senator Limmer, you want to begin with your Senate File 58? I'm sorry, 307.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm going to start with Senate File 307 regarding the disaster contingency account funds transfer. Many of you know that the disaster assistance contingency account will soon be exhausted, and it will be inadequate to meet existing requirements. We had some unique expenses that were created in St. Louis County earlier this past year when gale force windstorms and damaging waves and flooding began in October. And that put an impact on the current balance. The account has a balance right now of $500,000 with an anticipated known need of $2.9 million for the state share of a federally declared disaster in St. Louis County. This bill would transfer the needed $2.4 million from the general fund to the disaster assistance contingency account to address the shortfall that we currently are experiencing. This is kind of unique, members, that we aren't including this into a more of an omnibus budget provision because of the unique nature that we are running we are anticipating a deficit when those expenses come in. That natural disaster that happened in St. Louis County happened just in October. So it was something that we didn't really anticipate during our legislative session. We're trying to fill the need right now and move this quickly. And Senator Simonson, who also represents the Duluth area, is a co-author on this bill, and we're working together to address that need. I'll stand for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Members, any questions? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Come on forward.
Mr. Chair, there is in your packet a letter from the Commissioner of Public Safety that gets into a little more detail. This was the former commissioner. Her letter was dated December 14th, so she was reminding us of the immediate need to get this account in full standing.
And Joe Kelly, if you're going to come up to speak, if you'd come up too. Both of you can come up. I was thinking of somebody else. Okay, please have a seat up here. Mr. Kelly, if you would introduce yourself and continue with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Joe Kelly. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, where I serve as the State Emergency Management Director. Mr. Chair and members, I would just like to give you a little bit of background on the Disaster Assistance Contingency Account from its creation in 2014 to where we're at today to include the current status that Senator Limmer mentioned, that we are now at about $500,000 of available unencumbered funds. As members will recall, the account was established during the 2014 legislative session. The purpose is to provide the state funding for the non-federal share of a FEMA disaster, a presidentially declared disaster, and the state share of a gubernatorial declared disaster. One of the intended effects of the creation of the account was to avoid the requirement of the legislature to make specific appropriations every time there was a qualifying event in the state, as well as to cancel unneeded funds and so forth. So it created this contingency account to cover both federal and state disasters. Since the account was created, a little over $52 million have been appropriated by the legislature or transferred into the account when old disasters expired. And to date, about $51.5 million has been transferred out to provide disaster assistance to local governments. So we're talking about cities, counties, townships, and tribes, and the organizations and agencies thereof. So $52 million in, $51.5 million out is how we arrive at the approximate balance of about $500,000. Since the account was created, it has provided state funding for the state share of 3 presidentially declared disasters and 32 governor-declared, gubernatorial-declared disasters, and the split because of the amount of responsibility that the state has. Of that $50 million or so, is about $25 million for federal disasters and $25 million for state disasters. Since the last legislative session adjourned at the end of the session, an appropriation was made that brought the account balance to about $15 million. We had a lot of dark and stormy nights in Minnesota since then, a very active disaster season, and there were 12 qualifying events, 12 storms, if you will, because thankfully these were all natural disasters that qualified for either state or federal disaster assistance. We had 10 disasters, incidents where the governor authorized state disaster assistance because it was enough to cause the statutorily requisite amount of damage to local communities, but it wasn't big enough for the state to qualify for FEMA help. So we had 10 of those. And then we had one presidentially declared federal major disaster. It was, if you will recall, this summer in about the middle of June to the middle of July, we had about a month of rain. And all 4 corners of the state experienced the effects of these storms from the northeast, northwest, southwest, and southeast. The center part of the state, for some meteorological reason, was spared. But that storm did approximately $22 million worth of damage and eligible damage in Minnesota communities across 28 counties and 3 tribes. And again, that's some of the story of how we got to only $500,000 left in the account from $15 million in the preceding October. This October, on October 10th, as Senator Limmer described, the city of Duluth experienced what really is accurate to call it an inland Great Lakes hurricane. They had hurricane force winds, category 1 force winds, and they experienced that storm surge flooding that we hear about on the Weather Channel when hurricanes strike the coasts of the United States. And the damage was very similar to what communities experience during hurricanes. FEMA came to town at the state's request. We did a damage assessment, and it was determined there was about $11.5 million of eligible damage from that storm. At the end of November, the governor sent a request through FEMA to the president requesting a federal disaster declaration and making FEMA disaster recovery funds available. Typically takes between 30 and 45 days for a request to work its way through the process. Right at about that halfway point is when the federal government shut down and the furlough of a significant number of federal employees, include the majority of those that work for FEMA, occurred. So that declaration, in normal times we would have known by now, that declaration is currently on hold until the shutdown ends. Assuming that the president will declare a major disaster declaration for St. Louis County and the city of Duluth, as Senator Limmer points out, the state share of that relief will be $2.9 million. So the $500,000 in the current balance in the account combined with the proposed appropriation would cover, if you will, that known obligation. When the declaration is made, that would be transferred out into an allocation for the county, and the contingency account would be depleted. In the unlikely event, but still possible, that the president does not declare a federal emergency, then this would fall under the governor's authority to declare a state emergency, and the state responsibility then would be $8.7 million. So, Mr. Chair and members, that's kind of how we got to this point in the contingency account, and I would entertain any questions that the board may have.
Members have any questions for Mr. Kelly? Yes, Senator.
Just one quick question. This would leave the disaster fund essentially empty if we put the 2.4 in and then take the 2.9 out. Is that correct?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ralph, yes. That would we take the contingency account and we move the money out into allocations for. We would then be able to continue to pay on those current disasters that have already been declared and for which money has been allocated. But to your question, any new expenses, the money would not be in the account.
Senator Ralph.
So I'm assuming there's going to be an intention to bring a further request to refill that fund this year, or is that, you haven't decided that?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ralph, as the members know, the governor has not concluded his budget recommendation yet, so I can't speak for the governor. I would tell you that what I spelled out earlier, that by the time we have a Duluth declaration, the account will be depleted.
Okay. Senator Limmer, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File Number 307 be recommended to pass. Is there a recommendation?
Finance.
And be moved to the Finance Committee.
Members, Senator Limmer moves Senate File 307 and to be moved to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill is passed. Next bill is Senate File 112. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a number of testifiers that will be coming up at this time. This bill addresses the criminal gang investigative data retention extension. Currently, all legally identified gang members that are convicted are purged from the data system that identifies them as gang members 3 years after the last record of a conviction, or if it's not a conviction, an adjudication or a state adjudication of the individual. However, it's been found that many individuals are having their names purged while being incarcerated, but while they're incarcerated, they still are participating in gang-related activity while in prison. This bill recognizes that and would change the start of that three-year clock, so to speak, to be starting upon release, assuming that the individuals are still participating in ongoing gang criteria behavior. The three-year conviction period should begin once released from conviction. This behavior also would need to be documented, of course, by the Department of Corrections. We believe, or the sponsors of this, is that officer safety is being jeopardized as these people are removed from the list, even though they still may still be behaving as a violent gang member while in incarceration. The bill is before you. We have some individuals from the Department of Corrections that would wish to address this, and I think we can open it up for their testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Who'd like to go first?
Let me go first. Okay.
All right. Just Mr. Chair, yourself, yeah. If you would.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Daniel Hatton. I'm the police chief for the city of Hutchinson and the current president of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. Our association represents more than 500 law enforcement leaders, including more than 300 active police chiefs in communities large and small, urban and rural, all across this great state. I want to thank Senator Limmer for authorizing this bill and to thank all of you today for taking the time to hear what our members feel is a very important piece of legislation. The Criminal Gang Investigative Data System is a valuable resource for police officers' use in investigating criminal activity and obtaining information on people who are suspected of crimes. It is a tool used by police officers on the street to help them better understand if someone has gang affiliation. Currently, all legally identified gang members are purged from the data system 3 years after last record of conviction or adjudication or state adjudication. We have found that there are many individuals that have their names purged while being incarcerated, but still participating in gang-related activity, both inside the prison and outside the walls through communication means. This bill would change the start of that 3-year clock to upon release. Assuming that the individuals are still participating in ongoing gang criteria behavior during their placement, the 3-year conviction period should begin once released. This behavior, while incarcerated, also has to be documented by the Department of Corrections. Officer safety is being jeopardized as these people are removed from the list, even though they are still behaving in criminal, violent ways. The bill before you today will make this a better tool, a more sound resource. It will help officers better protect themselves and the citizens they serve in their communities. Our association stands in full support of this bill. It closes a loophole that allows incarcerated individuals who are still participating in documented gang activity behind bars to be purged from the database. We are concerned if officers don't have this accurate information once the individuals are released from prison that they could jeopardize themselves and again, their citizens they serve. So I thank you for your time, and I ask you for your full support of this Senate File 112. Thank you.
Thank you. If Mr. Melvin would like to testify then.
No, I'm not Mr. Melvin, but thank you, Mr. Chair. Afternoon, and members. My name is Mark Kinnear. I'm the Assistant Director for the Office of Special Investigations, Department of Corrections. I oversee the unit that identifies security threat groups throughout the Department of Corrections. That's why I'm here to answer any questions you might have regarding the Department of Corrections.
Okay, thank you. Members, do you have any questions? Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and testifiers. Refresh my memory as to where we came up with 3 years to start with. And the reason I ask is gangs, the knowledge that I have, probably not more so, or maybe a little bit more so than the general public, is that they're cultural in nature. The gangs are cultural, meaning a way of life, and really hard for them to get out of this. And I'm wondering why only 3 years? I don't know where that ever came from. I guess I don't understand that. Does anybody know that? Is that cumbersome to anybody? Should it be 5 years?
Well, Mr. Senator, the response is 5 years. I don't think really makes a difference to us. What we're seeing in the Department of Corrections is when an individual is convicted, they're normally convicted for longer than 3 to 5, maybe 6, 8, 10 years. And what they're doing is when that 3 years starts and come to the facility and do their time in the Department of Corrections, they continue to do their gang activity. And when they walk out the door, because there's that 3 to 5 years, I'm not able to put that individual in the pointer system for officer safety on the street.
I understand. Mr. Chair, I understand what the bill is, and I certainly support it. I'm just wondering if it was enough time, but you're right. They've been probably incarcerated for some time, and assuming that if there's any gang activity going on in the facility that they're being charged with that, I'm assuming that.
And yes, sir, that's true.
If there is something, some kind of...
Yeah, if it's gang-related or STG gang-related, they are charging discipline with that, correct.
All right. Okay, thanks.
To the testifier, could you spell your last name?
U-N-E-R.
Okay. I do have a question. What type of criminal gang behavior is happening when someone's in prison?
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'd have to answer that. There's several different things. There's extortion by gang members. There's assaults by gang members, called by gang members.
So is that inside the prison?
Yes,
or,
sir.
Okay, it's not affecting the outside.
No, sir.
Okay.
Sometimes it does.
Sure. Okay, that's good enough. Members, anything else? Yes, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So kind of a follow-up to that, to what Senator Hall asked, not just on the gang activity, because I understand the reason for this, but there are some people who probably go in as gang members and through the programs that you have, you know, try to leave and actually leave. And so to not, you know, keep them in the list, how do you go through that and how do you make that decision? Because, I mean, there are some people that actually, you know, are trying, and it's very hard even when they get out, because then they're usually going back to their same community and their same friends who then may try to drag them in. And so I understand that we're walking that fine line, but what kind of decisions do you look at to decide if they're still in and doing gang activity, aside from the crimes that you mentioned, but are there, like, criteria that you kind of look at, or just literally what happens?
Yes, Senator, we have criteria that we follow. If they have no criteria and stay out of trouble, abide by the rules, take their education, do all those things, after 5 years, they fall off the list. They're called an inactive STG member. Those are the individuals who do not go in the pointer system when they leave. Only individuals that continue to do their STG activity while incarcerated.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you give the committee a little idea as to how many gangs, identifiable gangs, there are in the state prison system and how many incidents actually occur resulting in crime outside the prison from the activity that's going on inside?
Mr. Yuner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, that's a very, very tough question for me to answer. Many, many gangs. Probably the biggest hurdle that we deal with, our investigators deal with on a daily basis, are the hybrid gangs from Minneapolis and St. Paul. There's so many new hybrid gangs coming in and out, trying to identify them. Hybrid gangs are younger individuals that are knockoffs of the traditional gangs like the GDs, the Vice Lords and stuff. They don't have a structure. It's very difficult for us. I would hate to give you guys a response of how much stuff that happens in the facilities is gang-related. It's a lot. It's a lot. Almost everything that happens in our correctional facility, it's probably stems from gang or STG-related.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Senator Hall. In reading this, I'm just a little bit confused, though. It looks to me that the individual doesn't necessarily have to be tied to the gang activity. Could you clarify, or maybe Senate Counsel could clarify, in this bill, the intent is that the individual is tied to that gang activity while they're incarcerated, right?
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and members, in order to have the extra 3-year period from release from incarceration, which this bill is all about, you know, if you look at 114 on, it says the commissioner has to document these activities meeting the criminal gang identification criteria that took place while confined in prison. So you would have to have that documented in order for the extra period to begin again.
Senator Johnson, follow up?
Yeah. Just a quick follow-up on that. So then here it says the commissioner documents the activities meeting gang identification while the individual is committed to the prison. But it doesn't necessarily say that the prisoner or the individual himself is tied to those activities, does it? Or I'm just reading this wrong.
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair, members, I guess I interpreted that as meaning one of the, what are we up to now, nine criteria identified or used by the Commissioner of Public Safety and the gang task force for identification as being part of a gang, which appears in, basically it's published by the Commissioner. If you wanted to see it, I can show it to you.
Maybe after we're done. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe after we're done, maybe you could show that to me.
Okay. Senator Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I don't have the list in front of me, is it possible that gang activity is described and there is actually finding that that person is engaged in it? Is there any further criminal charge brought, or is there any sort of a conviction at that point, or is it just something that goes into their prison history record? So, because if you had a conviction, of course, then that would start the three-year clock running again. And I'm just wondering about, obviously this must be a hole where there is not a conviction, but there's actual finding of activity. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Mr. Unit?
Mr. Chair, thanks. Mr. Senator, not always are they charged, and we call it our internal discipline. So if they assault another member and we can prove that it was gang-related or STG-related, they are charged with that, but not often. So when we do criminal complaints in the street and we have our criminal investigators throughout the department, if they can prove that that was gang-related, it is enhanced, and they are charged with a gang felony on the streets. It does not happen that often, if that answers your question.
Any other questions, members? Hearing none, Senator Limmer, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate file number 112 be recommended to pass.
Floor.
And move to the floor.
Senator Limmer moves Senate file 112 and recommends to move to the floor. Did I say that wrong? Oh. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Senator Limmer, your bill is passed. Seeing there's no further business, this committee is adjourned.